On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
It's an inevitable part of life that there is an end to that life. It may not come at the time we expect. It may not come in a way that we expect. But all of us are born knowing that someday we won't be here on the planet. To talk to us about developing perspectives and how to live your life in such a way that you are not crushed by the possibility of death, but encouraged by what can happen in the meantime, we're delighted to welcome Barbara Becker, writer and interfaith minister, who has dedicated more than 25 years to partnering with human rights advocates around the world in pursuit of peace and interreligious understanding. She has worked with the United Nations, Human Rights First, the Ms. Foundation for Women, and the Grameen Bank of Bangladesh, and has participated in a delegation of Zen peacemakers and Lakota elders in the sacred Black Hills of South Dakota. She has also sat at the bedside of hundreds of patients as a hospice volunteer. Her website is simple, barbarabecker.com. Her new book from Flatiron Books is The Art of Living with the End in Mind, Heartwood. Or maybe we should say Heartwood, The Art of Living with the End in Mind, from Flatiron Books. It is a Nautilus Book Award winner, and we are so pleased to have an opportunity to talk to Barbara. We had originally planned to talk to her earlier, but she had to get sick for a while. Happily enough, she is well, and we're delighted to have her here with us on the bookshelf. Thank you, Barbara, for joining us.
It is such a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for having me.
The interesting thing about your book to me is that you are sharing not just your own story, but the stories of people that were part of your life at one time or another, people who were an important part of your life for many years, and others that you just met a time or two in your work as a hospice volunteer. And yet you reminded me of something that I've known for a long time, but it still bears being reminded of, and that is that everyone has a story to tell, and everybody's life has things in it that are absolutely unique and wonderful. And it just seems to me that reading your book that this must be a huge encouragement for people who have been either dealing with the loss of a loved one or trying to figure out how to live a more purposeful life, for example.
Yes, that was one of the main motivating factors for me in writing the book, that when we're dealing with something as complicated and as deep as looking at our own mortality, everyone has a story to tell. And I really felt strongly that stories were the way into this topic, as opposed to, say, for instance, a list of the five things you need to know before you die.
Right. You have a pretty eclectic background as far as studying different types of faiths and religions, not just ones that the average person would run into. And certainly in the South, we are kind of the buckle on the Bible bet down here. So most people who are live lives of faith are people who are Christians, and most of which are in the Protestant version of Christianity, although we do have Native American tribes in the area and all of that. But your experience has been a lot more varied than that. Tell us how you got involved in these different types of philosophies and your other interfaith work.
Well, I also grew up in a Protestant Christian tradition in the North, in New Jersey, where my family had been mostly from Holland, and they practiced Dutch Reformed Christianity. And I had amazing exposure to a broader and broader number of Christian traditions, most notably when I went to college. I went to a college that had Quaker background, and Quakerism really believes in the internal spark of God within everyone. And I was profoundly moved by that. You know, a Quaker service is one where the parishioners sit in silence until someone is motivated to speak. And that just kind of blew my mind and opened me to Eastern traditions as well, where meditation and reflection are practiced. And then because New York City, where I live, is such a diverse place, I ended up meeting people of all different religious and spiritual traditions and ended up marrying a Jewish man and raising Jewish children.
So you've had exposure to a lot of different faiths, ways of dealing with loss and with dealing with difficulties and so forth. The very beginning of the book where you talk about your friend Marissa, this was a really kind of a shock for you, wasn't it? That this is your childhood friend and she discovers that she has stage 4 cancer 10 months before her wedding to her college sweetheart. At the age of 30, she finds out that she's got this very difficult situation to face. And by the time that she is 39, it's gotten much more serious. And this would, of course, be the kind of thing that would make you start on a journey to exploring the meaning of loss and love.
That's exactly right. And Marissa was a dear, dear friend to me from our earliest days of childhood. And she was so vital and funny and just incredibly full of life and love. And it was a shock to find out that she had terminal cancer. And when Marissa was given a year left to live, and the doctors said they couldn't do anything more for her, I watched her approach life with an energy and a passion that was kind of shocking to me. It was quite beautiful, the way that she spent time with family and friends and had laughter and joy in her life. It seemed impossible to me. So I, on the other hand, was an anxious mess, and I decided to do what I do when I'm faced with difficult challenges in my life, which is to read absolutely everything I could get my hands on. And I learned that wise people throughout time, from the Buddha to Stoic philosophers like Seneca and Marcus Aurelius, to our own Henry David Thoreau, they have all advised us that if we want to live fully, we should live with the end in mind, to remember that we are fragile, mortal beings rather than trying to deny that fact. So that was very eye-opening for me and the start of my journey to look at my own mortality and the mortality of others around me.
I suppose it's almost a cliche to say this, but that we don't really begin to live until we embrace the fact that that none of us gets out of this alive. And therefore, life is precious, and we don't want to squander it, but we do want to do meaningful things and experience great joy. And the second chapter of the book, you talk about a discovery that you made that was kind of a real surprise. And I can imagine it must have been an even bigger surprise for you to live this than it was for me to read about this. And that was to find out that your mother was not the only person that your father had ever been married to, and that his first wife died, and that there was still a potential connection with this person that none of you and your siblings had ever known.
That's right. I was just a young girl, about 8 years old, when I was snooping around in my dad's wallet one day when he was out. And I had discovered a picture of a woman tucked behind the picture of my mom, and I pulled it out. And she was quite beautiful. She was dressed as a nurse. I had no idea who she was. And then my mom walked in and caught me in the act. And I demanded to know who this was. And she told me that it was my dad's first wife and that her name had been Maureen. And as time went on, I found out more and more about Maureen in sort of a very age-appropriate way from my parents. My dad and Maureen had been married for just a couple of weeks. It was after their honeymoon when she died in a tragic boating accident. And I learned that, you know, my dad still kept Maureen's letters. They were a beautiful treasure trove of love letters that I hoped to have something similar in my own life someday. And, you know, I write in the book that someone had to die for me to live. And I felt that sort of existential quest so early. Like, if Maureen hadn't died, I never would have been born. You know, she was a very like benevolent figure in my childhood home, to the point where my mom, who was very saint-like, actually had a wreath laid on Maureen's grave every Christmas in her honor. So that was a beautiful way of bringing in the memory of Maureen and not being threatened by her.
I just found that so lovely, and just what a great window it is into the soul of your mom, that she would do something as gracious as that. It also informed you as to why your father was so adamant against things that you figured were fairly benign, that he was really adamant about you not water skiing, say, or doing boating or anything. And you found out that's how his first wife died, in a boating accident.
Yes, we do relive our fears over and over again. And I would say my dad tried to get back on that proverbial horse. He would take out boating books and take us on little trips on boats as my childhood went on. But I could see how fear dominated his life in some ways, and it was well-founded. I mean, he had lost this primary love of his life, and he didn't want to lose anybody else that way. So I could put myself in his shoes and really see how it's our fears and our mental constructs around stories about death that are sometimes what cause us such paralysis.
We're talking, in case you're just joining us, to Barbara Becker, the author of Heartwood, The Art of Living with the End in Mind, from Flatiron Books. It's a Nautilus Book Award winner. It addresses some very eternal quandaries, you know. How do we live our life in such a way that it matters? How do we make the most of the time that we have and not be in fear of what lies before us, even when things are looking very serious indeed? When we get a diagnosis that doesn't leave out much room for hope, do we flail against the night, or do we say, well, this is a part of living, that everyone will die, and what are we going to do with the time that we have? One of the things that you write about in the book that I thought was very interesting, I was a bivocational Methodist minister for 29 years, and as such, one of the things that I learned was that there was a time, and that time may still be, that women did not talk openly about having a miscarriage, that it was seen as a private sadness, and nobody, you know, nobody offered them solace or anything like that. For some women, it seemed to be something that they had to deal with time and time again. And when I first met someone and found out that they adopted a child because she had lost so many babies, including a pair of twins, it just hit me right in the heart, and I wondered how many losses like that could you take before you just gave up on the idea completely. And I read in the book that this is something that you had to come to grips with too.
Yes, I decided if I was going to take a look at mortality, I really needed to go back and explore the two miscarriages that my husband and I had about 20 years ago now. Fortunately for us, we now have two sons who were born in between where our daughters would have been born. And today we start learning on social media that celebrities have had miscarriages, and there's just a more openness to discussions, although I would say it's still quite a taboo topic. But I demanded silence. I just didn't want to talk about it. I asked my husband not to talk about it, which was really not too fair for him. Mm-hmm. I think I was afraid of people's pity. I mean, it was an emotion that I didn't want to deal with. I didn't want people feeling sorry for me. Several years later, I went on Facebook. It was October 15th, which is the National Day of Mourning Infant and Early Childhood Loss. And I put up a few lines about our story, and I told people for the first time that we had had these two miscarriages. And I invited people to do the same in the comments. And before I knew it, the comments were full of women and men responding that they too had lost children. And the amazing thing about that to me was that of the, say, 100 responses, I knew all of those people very well. And I only knew half of those stories.
Mm. I discovered, I think my mom finally told me when I was 30 or so, I'm the oldest of four kids, as far as I knew. And then she told me one day, it just sort of came out in a conversation, that actually she had lost a child between my sister and my youngest brother. And she had never mentioned it. We didn't know as children that this was going on. Dad never mentioned it. But it was his loss, too. And when I found that out, it gave me a great appreciation for how really difficult it is to be a human being. And when later on I became a pastor, that gave me at least a place to start in thinking about women who experience and the dads too, you know, because most of the time we just think it's a woman's loss because she's bearing the child, but it's not. It's like any significant loss. It's the loss of a dream. This is a person that you looked forward to having in your family, and then he or she was no longer there. And so it's a loss for both parents. And I was really encouraged by the words that you wrote about it in handling and that you and David see it together, and you named the girls. And so I think that is huge, because that makes them people. And we need to remember they have been people. They just didn't get to breathe our air, but they were people, and they were beloved, and they were anticipated, and they are not forgotten. I think that's a really great lesson. You were there on a day that caught everyone in America by surprise and changed the attitude, I think, in a lot of parts of the United States. There were always sort of in kind of a certain amount of antagonism toward New York City. But after 9/11, all that kind of evaporated, at least for a very long time. And we began to see people looking at New York City, not just this great big city a long way off that thought they were so great, and the people were rude, blah, blah, blah. We saw it. This is a whole bunch of people like us, and they have gone through this terrible, terrible thing, and we've got to help. And people from the United States, all over the United States, went to New York to help. You were there. I can't even imagine how startling that must have been. I was on the radio when we had a TV monitor in our studio and saw both planes hit. I immediately got on the air and told people something had happened in New York City and so forth, but it still was removed from me for several thousand miles. For you, it was just a matter of a few miles, right?
Yes. I was walking to work that morning, and I was on my way to dropping off my one-year-old son, Evan, at a daycare center, which was part of Trinity Church, which was literally right next door to the towers. So we were just a couple of blocks away when I heard a thunderous noise. I had no idea what it was until Evan reached up his little finger and pointed to the sky and started yelling, "Fire, fire, Mama, fire." And I will tell you that that little boy repeated the word fire as one of his first words over and over again for months. It was so unsettling. But even more unsettling than the words were that as I stood there and I watched what was happening, I saw something fall from the sky. And I realized right then and there that it wasn't something, it was someone. And I witnessed several people jumping from the building that day. It's a sight that will never leave your mind.
This, the chapter where you talk about this, you have a quote from a t-shirt that you saw in the window of an East Village shop, which I think is marvelous. There are only two ways to live your life. One is as though nothing is a miracle. The other as though everything is. I think that is a great shirt. I am actually going to get that shirt made because I am one of those that looks at life and sees the hand of God in everything. And for me, everything's a miracle. But I understand the people that have had terrible, terrible tragedies and had to figure a way through them. You were a hospice volunteer after you became an interfaith minister at the age of 50. And a lot of the book talks about the people that you met through that ministry as well.
Yes, I decided that if I was going to be first taking on death as a teacher in my life, I had to learn to show up for people who were dying firsthand. You know, it wasn't enough to read about it in books or to talk to people after their family members had died. So I learned about two Zen monks who have an organization based in New York City where they train people to be a compassionate presence at the bedside. They were absolutely wonderful, very full of spark and life and love. And in the course of being trained by them, I ended up at Bellevue Hospital, which is our enormous public hospital in New York City. And because this city serves a huge diversity of people, I got to experience patients who were from all different kinds of religious traditions. They might be Muslim, they might be Hindu. I had a Maori woman one day who had come to New York City as an art student. She thought she would be here for a short while. And as soon as she got here, she was diagnosed with a terminal illness. And she was on her deathbed all alone. And one day when I was talking to her, she said to me, "You know, Barbara, I'm really not alone." And I said, "What do you mean by that?" And she said, "Well, in my New Zealand Maori background, that's the indigenous tradition of New Zealand, we believe that our ancestors come and greet us at the bedside and reach out a hand and help bring us to the other side." And I was so moved by that. And I really realized right then and there that being able to approach death and dying from many different world and religious and spiritual views was going to be really important to me.
You've got wonderful stories to tell and a difficult story, but this is yet another life lesson that you're going through now, that you were recently diagnosed with breast cancer just as your book was being released. And there are lessons that you have learned in this new chapter as well, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, talk about the ironies. The very day that Heartwood was being released, I was having surgery for breast cancer. And I was really forced to take a look at my own book for any words of wisdom from the people that I had written about. And what I think about often is the line from the Eastern religious traditions, which is that this is a world of 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows. And in our culture, we talk so much about the joys and being young and being healthy, but we ignore the part where we bump into life's difficulties. But when we're able to balance them, when we're able to dance with the joys and the sorrows, I think that that's where the real potential for life's richness comes flooding in.
Barbara, before we go, is there anything that you had hoped that I would ask you about that I neglected to ask?
What a great question. I mean, people often say, you know, what if talking about death, my own death, is just too much for me? I can't do it. I suggest that people start small, and we start with the everyday goodbyes because they're great practice ground. So when someone in your home is leaving for the day, going to school, going to the grocery store, it's a good time rather than to call out over our shoulder, bye, you know, to really just stop, get up, you know, say goodbye, greet people, say goodbye, you know, eye to eye. And I think in this way, we start letting in some of that preciousness of life.
And I would be remiss if I did not ask Barbara about the prognosis for the breast cancer with which she was diagnosed just as Heartwood was coming out. And so what do they say?
Thank you so much for asking that. My prognosis is actually really good. It was caught early. You know, I think the interesting thing was when the doctor told me I had breast cancer, I think as a result of writing Heartwood, I didn't think, why me? I really thought, why not me?
Yeah.
It really does flip things.
Yeah. Well, when you realize the pain and suffering that other people go through, it does change the way you look at suffering and pain. To think of it as, well, this is a mean and cruel thing to happen, but to say, well, things happen to everyone, and this is what's happening to me. But other people have dealt with it, and I look to their example as pioneers before me on this road for insight and encouragement. And I think...
Yes.
Yeah.
I often call women the women survivors, the sisterhood of survivors. We really have this interconnection between one another that's so profound.
I think that this is a great place for us to finish our time together, offering that hope and offering that support, and that seems to wrap it all up in a bow. So again, I applaud your openness with the losses that you share with us in your very extraordinary life and some of the extraordinary people that you have met that we didn't get to even talk about. So I encourage people to look for a copy of Heartwood, The Art of Living with the End in Mind from Flatiron Books. It's available all over the place. I know bookstores everywhere and online and everything as well. And once again, your website is BarbaraBecker.com.
That's right. And there's a reader's guide on that website. And lots of churches across the country are starting to take it on as a reading group book.
Barbara, thank you so much. And I appreciate you making time to talk to me today. I'm glad that you're better. And I hope that the book is used by lots and lots of people to help them get a sense of life and a joy for living. And that this is what comes shining through this book to me, that life is a great gift to be lived, and we only have so long, so make the most of it. Barbara, thank you for letting us take some of your very precious time, and thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much. The honor is all mine.
We'll see you next week right here on your favorite radio station and on your favorite podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.